Let me welcome you to another one of MoMA's Brown Bag Lunch Lecture Series. My name is Rich Turnbull, and I wanted to first of all tell you a little bit about the title, which I believe is the longest title I have ever written for a Brown Bag Lunch Lecture. When we, of course, set up these lectures, we're generally working about maybe 6 months or so in advance of the event itself. And when I was asked, you know, what did I want to talk about for the fall, did I want to propose anything, et cetera, I started thinking about some of the questions that the general public very often poses, you know, to lecturers, to guards on the first floor, et cetera. And I started thinking about the fact that there are a number of paintings in MoMA's permanent collection which are quite well loved by the general public and which are, shall we say, not quite so well loved by the curators in the Department of Painting and Sculpture and, for example, by critics at large. And I thought it might be interesting to really kind of examine the dynamic between the two and ask questions about, well, do the curators, you know, do they really feel like they have to put certain paintings on display simply because the public really likes them, even though the curators and critics, you know, may be undecided, et cetera, et cetera. And I did speak to some people in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, mostly not for attribution, and mostly nobody wanted to say anything that they might get in trouble for later. So I have some very kind of vague, ethereal remarks to add to our discourse today. And I thought, you know, in particular, if we look at some of these works that are basically popular favorites, but kind of critical and curatorial disfavorites, if you like, it does give us a way, one among many, to examine the kind of narrative that a museum like MoMA provides in its permanent collection. You know, you can start asking really interesting questions about, well, why are the things that are on view, and why do you look at them in the order that they're, in fact, displayed in the various galleries on the different floors upstairs, etc. And this is really kind of a microcosm. Originally, you can see the title was Popular Favorites and Critical Disdain, from Pavel Chelichev's Hide and Seek to Andrew Wyeth's Christina's World. One of the things I've done is I flipped the order of that the more I thought about how to talk about this. And then, since there's a fair amount to say about each of these, we're not really going from one to the other. Those are the two paintings that we'll be talking about today, since there's only so much you can cover in a relatively short lecture like this. And these are the two paintings in question. You know, a lot of you are probably familiar with Andrew Wyeth's Christina's World, which currently is on display up in the fifth floor in the permanent collection. It's that small and perhaps rather sad last little room of the fifth floor galleries that you walk through when you've just finished examining, for example, European Dada and Surrealism. And it's the space that's been allotted to the early phase of American modernism. So Christina's World is there, and it's been there pretty much since the new museum opened, which will be 3 years ago, next month, actually. And these days, in the current installation, there is an Edward Hopper in that room. There are two works by Thomas Hart Benton. There's also a work by the early American modernist Charles Sheeler, who's somebody who orbited in the influence of Alfred Stieglitz. And what's interesting about that, of course, is if you're a regular MoMA goer, you know that MoMA's version of modernism, in terms of the American component of the avant-garde, is solidified by the fact that you really don't see much in the way of American art until you get to the fourth floor, and until you get to the advent of the New York School, abstract expressionism, etc. And this coincides with the move from Paris to New York as more or less the capital of the avant-garde, for various reasons, for political reasons, etc., the outbreak of World War II, and all of these events. And as far as MoMA is concerned, that's the real key moment in American modernism. If you wanted to know earlier versions of the story, that, for example, there is a fair amount of American modernism prior to the 1930s, you would probably think about Alfred Stieglitz. You'd think about a lot of the artists that circled around him, his occasional wife, Georgia O'Keeffe, for example, somebody like John Maron, Charles Demuth, Arthur Dove, Marsden Hartley, all of these sort of artists who actually are not in particular abundance in MoMA's permanent collection. So one of the reasons, I mean, what turns out with why these paintings are where they are, why you see Christina's World but you don't see Chelichev's Hide and Seek, at least for the moment, has a lot to do with the way that museums think of their own collections. It has a lot to do with the story or the narrative that museums provide, in this case of the story of modernism in painting and sculpture and other forms. And it has a lot to do with exactly what's in the permanent collection and what you can relate what you have to what else is in the collection. And all of these things go together to really form the base. It's kind of our starting point for today. And although we can ask a lot of questions about this, we're not necessarily going to come up with answers for every one of these things. I wanted to start with Christina's world because it's very ubiquitous at MoMA. In fact, if you talk, as I have, to some of the people who work in the administrative capacities, for example, on the first floor, when you first come in and when you get your tickets and check your coats and, you know, go to the merchandising units, otherwise known as the gift shop, et cetera. If you ask a lot of the people like the guards, what's one of the questions they get most often? Probably third in order after where are the bathrooms and where is Starry Night will be where is Christina's world? You know, this is a painting that a lot of people know about before they even get here, which I think is not necessarily true of the vast number of works in the collection. And people want to know where this is. They want to go see it. You know, I wouldn't say they stampede up to the fifth floor to see it, but they certainly make their way up there. And it's a kind of a known quantity at MoMA. And the interesting thing about that is that Wyeth, you know, has really two sorts of reputations. He has a public reputation in terms of the way the general public has always reacted to Wyeth's work. And then there is what you might call the critical and curatorial reputation. And these two reputations, almost more so than any other 20th century artist I can think of, are really quite separate in a lot of ways. I mean, if you know the artist Thomas Kincaid, painter of light, I would say that the popular reputation, the critical reputation, that's actually quite a bit further apart, since there's absolutely no critic or curious that takes those paintings seriously for various reasons. Wyeth is not quite at that level, but there is an interesting kind of dynamic or discourse, I think, between these two particular reputations. What's interesting is that the general public very rarely asks, where is Chelyachev's Kashkash, or hide and seek, as it's translated into English? In part because unless you have been a real serious regular MoMA goer for the last 10 years, the painting has in fact not been on display since, I think, about 1999. You know, in one of those versions of the MoMA 2000 series of exhibitions, just before the museum shut down here in Manhattan so the new building could be built, moved out to Queens briefly, moved back here. Since that point, we haven't seen Chelyachev's Hide and Seek. And unless you really knew that that painting was here, you wouldn't even know to ask for it in some ways. It doesn't quite have the same visibility as, let us say, Christina's world. Although, interestingly enough, someone who was at the Monday version of this lecture, which is roughly the same, it's not like I'm giving two completely separate talks about this, who worked in family programs, says she gets questions all the time because teachers and people who administer programs, particularly for school kids, love that painting. And they're used to showing it in their visits to MoMA, particularly if they've done that for years or even decades. And of course, they wonder, where is that painting? And they're often very sad, apparently, that it's not on display when they get here. And we'll talk a little bit about why that's the case and what the plans are for Chelyachev's Hide and Seek as well. I thought it would be interesting to talk about Christina's world, first of all, by telling you exactly what the museum tells you about this painting. There is, at the moment, no narrated text on the Acousta Guide, which you can get on the first floor and listen to people talking to you about various works in the collection, etc. That may or may not change, but the label copy was fairly recently rewritten. It's dated 2007 now, as a matter of fact. It's the same label copy that's on the website. If you go to MoMA's website, MoMA.org, and you do a search for Andrew Wyeth, you'll come up with pretty much the same information. And, of course, the wall label tells us that Wyeth is an American artist, born in 1917. And unlike Chelyachev, as you'll see, he's still with us. He's still very much alive. That this painting, Christina's World, was done in 1948. That it is not an oil painting, which is what a lot of people assume. It, in fact, is a tempera painting on a piece of gessoed board. So it's a wooden board with a layer of gesso or plaster material over it. And it's roughly speaking about 3 feet high, maybe 4 feet wide. And in fact, it came into the museum's collection not because it was given by somebody, but it was purchased by the museum at the time. And I'll quote to you the wall label because it sort of tells you what you're looking at. And this is, you know, MoMA's version of what you're looking at here. The woman crawling through the tawny grass was the artist's neighbor in Maine, who, crippled by polio, was limited physically, but by no means spiritually. Wyeth further explained, "The challenge to me was to do justice to her extraordinary conquest of a life which most people would consider hopeless." He recorded the landscape, The rural house and shacks with great detail, painting minute blades of grass, individual strands of hair, and nuances of light and shadow. In this style of painting, known as magic realism, everyday scenes are imbued with poetic mystery. And that's pretty much the extent of, you know, the information that the curators provide to you when you're looking at this painting. That's the extent of the wall label, etc. Nowhere in there and nowhere on the website is there any indication that there's not exactly kind of a consensus of opinion among curators, among critics, and among the public about whether this is a great masterpiece, whether it's a kind of an overrated popular masterpiece, etc. So I find that interesting that there's no real indication of what you might call the controversy behind the painting overall. Now, we've explained where you find this painting. I'm sure a lot of you have in fact seen this painting before. What this painting is really about, you know, what Wyeth was doing here, is it's a depiction of one of these two physical locations, both rural in nature, in Chadsford, Pennsylvania, and in Cushing, Maine. The painting is situated at a site called Olson's Farm, which was owned by Christina and Alvaro Olson. And the woman you see, Christina, in Christina's world, is Christina Olson. She is the wife. She's sort of the matriarch of the farm. And Wyeth was drawn to, first of all, rural locations, but these two particular locations in general. This one site called Kerner's Farm in Chadsford, Pennsylvania, and Olson's Farm in Cushing, Maine. And he returned to these on a regular basis, you know, because of the climatic eccentricities of Maine, which means you don't want to go there in winter ever. Mostly Wyeth spent summers in Maine. And he managed, you know, he knew both of these people. He considered them to be friends. They considered him to be a friend. And they gave him really free access to the property. And they allowed him to set up a studio in each of the houses in these two particular locations. And Wyeth returned to these, and he really recorded in an almost obsessive way the landscape, the architecture, what you might call the flora and fauna, sometimes single objects that he found. He was drawn to these subjects really over and over and over again. And you can see, even from the reproduction on the screen, that there is a very minute sense of detail. There's a very craftsmanlike quality in which Wyeth worked the surfaces of this painting, particularly the blades of grass. And although, again, you don't see this on a flat digital reproduction, if you go upstairs, you know, if when the lecture is over, you stampede up to the fifth floor, like I've suggested, and look at the actual surface of the painting, one of the things you will notice is the texture. You will see how carefully Wyeth worked the texture of the painting. And that's something that I think, you know, draws people into it. And he's a very careful, very close observer of textures, of buildings, of landscapes, and what have you. For example, the house, that's the Olson farmhouse in the upper right-hand corner of the painting. I found a photograph. It's not a great detail, or not really great resolution, but you can see that from the photograph of the house, which you can still visit today, you know, which is open to the public, that's a pretty much very faithful, very naturalistic, essentially true-to-life representation of the house itself. From the actual texture of the boards, the windows, you know, the chimneys, the sloping roof, the dormer windows up on top, all of it's there, and all of it is very faithfully reproduced. And I think that when you look at Wyeth's work, if you've seen some of Wyeth's work, you can't help but be, in a sense, drawn in by his feel for objects and textures. Another painting from the same series is called Christina's Teapot, which you see on the screen here. And this is, you know, Wyeth believed in truth in packaging, so this is the teapot that Christina Olson very often used. And what you see when you look at this is a real feel and an attempt to capture not just the light and shadow, the way the light reflects off the ceramic surface, but all of those details of texture in the object itself and in the surroundings. And I think if you're trying to locate Wyeth in some art historical framework, he always reminds me first and foremost of the type of attention, for example, that Dutch Baroque painters paid to interiors, to exteriors. You think back to painters like Rembrandt and certainly Vermeer with his interior scenes, etc. There's a great love in the 17th century in the Netherlands for actual objects, which you might call the materials of the world. And painters worked extremely hard to translate those into paint. And certainly some of that impulse is present in Wyeth's work as well. In fact, when people talk about Wyeth, and there's a vast literature about Wyeth and his work. You know, there are many, many publications, there are magazine articles, there are all sorts of critical reviews, etc. There's an enormous amount of stuff available, you know, both in book and journal form and online, if you do online searches, etc. One of the things that people almost always talk about in praise of Wyeth is, in particular, his technique and this obvious love of objects and texture. There's a tendency among critics to think of Wyeth as basically a rural artist rather than a modern artist. And this can start us to think a little bit about reactions to and critiques of Wyeth's work, criticism of Wyeth and his place. And there's a sense that you read in the literature overall that rural art is basically inseparable from place. It has a kind of very distinct geographic location. You can think back to a lot of like American regionalist painting in the 30s, like, for example, Thomas Hart Benton. And modern art, at least as it's defined in the canon of modernism throughout the 20th century, in fact, is a kind of placeless art. Modern art exists. It's partly, its reason for being modern is that it is essentially placeless. It's very often defined that way. And Wyeth's treatment of these relatively isolated locations in Maine and Pennsylvania, which he seemed to see really as kind of almost preserves of certain rural qualities that he admired, appreciated, etc., despite the fact that, you know, there was modernization and industrialization and cars and highways and eventually strip malls and everything else being built around these places. This seems to have been kind of an enclave for Wyeth, something he returned to over and over again, where something very old and deep and true was somehow preserved. In other words, very often a painting like Christina's World or paintings set in either of these locations are viewed as kind of nostalgic documents, you know, for the good old-fashioned days before all of the encroachments of modernism appeared and quite literally reconfigured the landscape. And of course, you know, you can see where this, in a sense, this one strand of critique is going, because if there's one thing that modernism in art, in the visual arts, is not about, it's nostalgia. You know, the two are really kind of at opposite poles of the aesthetic spectrum. You might also make a case that, you know, nostalgia is not really part of postmodernism in the 70s either, although that, the lines are a little bit fuzzier there. You can be nostalgic, but apparently you have to be ironic at the same time, you know, if you're going to be postmodern. And I will leave it up to you as to how you actually do that on any given day. There are lots of generally and sometimes generic critiques of Wyeth. I wanted to quote to you from a critic, Brian O'Doherty, who wrote a very long piece called The Voice and the Myth, American Masters. And at one point he says, "The hatred of Wyeth in informed circles is matched only by his audience's identification of abstraction with communism," which I think is a somewhat simplified way of looking at this kind of popular divide in terms of modernism versus, you know, realism versus abstraction away. I don't seriously think that anybody really thinks that way anymore. Communism is not really quite the hot topic that it might have been, let's say, in the 1950s or 1960s at this point. But it's sort of symptomatic of the way that popular opinion was divided about realism and, you know, this new growth of abstraction in the New York School and an abstract expressionism in the late 30s and 40s and early 50s, when it was kind of triumphed and pushed as the major form of American painting, and as, you know, as America's contribution to the avant-garde, to modernism, etc. Wyeth, in some ways, another thing that O'Doherty pointed out is that you can look at people like Andrew Wyeth and Andy Warhol and see them as kind of opposite poles, you know, of the developments, particularly in American art in the 20th century as well. Whereas Wyeth and Warhol become the epitomes, respectively, of rural painters and urban painters. And one of the things that O'Doherty points out in this piece that I'm quoting to you from is that Wyeth is very often seen as sort of a sophisticated primitive painter, and that somebody like Warhol is a primitive sophisticate at the same time. And when you sort of think about that, in fact, that actually seems to work out quite nicely. It's a bit generic, and it's a bit of a generalization, but there's still quite a bit of truth that's in there. The problem that I think many people have with Wyeth's work in terms of critical reception to it, and in some ways, we might say curatorial reception, although again, there's really nothing for attribution here, is that it seems to deal a lot not only with nostalgia but with sentiment. And one of the things that, that modernist art is very clearly is unsentimental, or you might argue anti-sentimental. And that, again, you could argue shifts a little bit in the 70s with the advent of postmodernism, et cetera. And a very pointed criticism of Wyatt's work and style was made by the very brilliant American author who died just about 2 years ago, Guy Davenport, you know, who wrote critical essays all across the board, mostly as a literary critic. But he was also a translator of poetry and wrote enormous amounts of avant-garde fiction, etc. And he basically at one point said the problem in Wyeth's work is that Wyeth, by the time you look at a Wyeth painting, he's made all the decisions for you. You know, everything is sort of laid out and there isn't really much in the way of participation on your part. And that appears to be also very kind of anti-modern in many ways. Wyeth's innumerable followers, many of whom are sometimes considered to be more skilled than he is, and this is a sentence from Brian O'Doherty again, present the simulacrum of nature without the voiced cliches, lovingly reinterred. Now that sounds very mysterious. In fact, like a lot of contemporary criticism, I just point that out as an example of the sort of things you find in the literature about Wyeth. It sounds like a very mysterious and somehow deeply meaningful sentence. It's really just an example of bad writing. You know, there is not a lot of clarity. Sometimes a lot of contemporary criticism is filled with jargon, etc. And this is one of those interesting sentences that sounds like there's an enormous amount to unpack there. And in fact, when you look at it, it's just very kind of fuzzy, muddled thinking overall. But then O'Doherty goes on to say something very forceful. He says, Wyeth thus leads an army of dead men bent on repealing modernism and restoring moral health through the trinity of nature, nationalism, and godliness. Wyeth, who shares their political views, is an outsider aligned on the right against the modernist conspiracy. And again, while that is somewhat absolutist, there is, I think, a good deal of basically popular truth embedded in that particular statement. I think that, you know, the popular taste and critical taste about this painting are always going to be divided. There's not going to be any sort of mediation or meeting ground or any truce called at any one point. And it's interesting, too, that this painting has lent itself to an enormous amount of satire. You know, part of the responses against Wyeth's work have come in the form of satire and parody. And I was hunting around on the internet for various things, you know, that might include this as satire. One interesting thing I found is this painting. It's the same painting with an image of a guinea pig photoshopped into it. And this was actually posted by a Guinea Pig Appreciation Society, which I was previously unaware existed, but apparently there are people who are very fond of those, you know, slightly squeaking, rodent-like things that many people have for pets. And that this is now Christina with her guinea pig, Sparky. And even more obvious was this particular, this is a kind of a fake advertisement. Christina's beer is the king of beers. This, of course, is not something that Budweiser could actually, that the marketing department of Budweiser couldn't really release this as an ad, you know, because of copyright issues, et cetera. But it's a website that sponsors a lot of very radical ads that essentially cannot exist, but perhaps could exist. This is sort of like the ultimate marketing of Christina in Christina's world by suggesting that she's gazing longingly at this triumvirate of icy cold Budweiser beers in the distance where Olsen's house might have been. And surprisingly, you would think that this would be the tenor of most of the reaction, you know, to someone like Wyeth. I always think that a lot of the, you know, the discussion about Wyeth, and this is true among a lot of practicing artists too, who see him as, you know, sort of a consummate craftsman because of the level of craft and workmanship and, you know, handcrafted quality that goes into paintings, etc. And modernism in some ways distances itself from this idea of craft. You know, this is something that artists have been arguing about both ways, back and forth, right back to the 19th century. You certainly see it, I mean, in terms of design, William Morris and John Ruskin and even the Gothic revivalist Augustus Pugin were talking about this in the 19th century in terms of architecture and design. This idea of craftsmanship versus, you know, content is something that still gets discussed today. It gets discussed in photography, it gets discussed in contemporary art, where many people, you know, don't see their techniques as an end unto itself. And more traditionally based artists sometimes do see that, and they would allow Wyeth to fit into that particular category. What's surprising is that there is some contemporary, what you might even call postmodernist art, that uses Wyeth as a starting point. And the example that I come across that I like to show in my photography classes is there is a photographer named Collier Shore, who in fact did a photo essay, where she photographed a German adolescent boy that she'd met in her various trips to Germany over about 3 years or so. And what she did is she photographed him assuming the poses of the Helga pictures, this very famous series of paintings by Wyeth that were kind of revealed and published basically sort of like the mid to late 1980s. And one of the things that Collier Shore did is she took this German kid, whose name is Jens F., and she allowed him to pose as Helga, not just in dozens, but like literally hundreds of scenarios. And she talks about using Wyeth's Helga pictures as a kind of template where she could investigate the identity, you know, of this particular German boy, and through that, issues of her own investigation of self-identity. And it's a complicated work, and we can't really do it justice just by mentioning it here, but it's something to be aware of, that Wyeth is not, he doesn't automatically have this sort of, you know, red flag when contemporary artists look at source material and think about ways of recontextualization and whatnot. And certainly for Collier Shore, he was a very resonant starting point. And she developed a whole long photo essay, which was just published as an actually very expensive book last year. Now, if we turn to the other painting that I wanted to discuss today, this is, again, for those of you who are regular MoMA aficionados who remember, who've been coming here not just for years but for decades, you probably do remember this painting because you've probably seen it at one point or another. It's this enormous work by the Russian-born artist Pavel Chelichev, and it is in fact a painting which is called Hide and Seek, or Cache-Cache, which is the French name for this child's game. It's a painting that was produced between about 1940 and 1942. It is an oil on canvas. It's quite large. It's about 6.5 feet wide, and it's nearly 7 feet high. And the size of the work, I think, presents the curators here with some interesting dilemmas about, you know, where do we actually put this, and what do we put it with in some cases. Chelichev is generally considered to be an American artist because that's where he wound up. You know, he wound up in the United States. He was born in 1898 in Russia. He died in 1957 in Italy. I think he moved back to Italy at that point. He had escaped with his family to Kiev when the Russian Revolution broke out in 1917. He joined the White Army, which was the remnants of the Tsarist army at the time. Eventually, when the White Army was defeated by the Red Army and, you know, communism rang triumphantly through the land, et cetera, et cetera, Chelichev got a medical discharge from the White Army, wound up first in Constantinople, or modern-day Istanbul, later wound up working in Germany in the early 1920s, eventually made his way to Paris. He spent time in England. He was in Spain for a while. He came to the United States. He was back in England, back in Italy. I mean, he was a kind of a very well-traveled artist in the 20th century. And although Chelichev had an early ambition to be a painter while he was growing up in Russia, much of his work was actually channeled into stage design, painting, for example, backdrops for modernist theatrical productions. And this is something a lot of his early work included, you know, paintings of jugglers and acrobats. There were portraits. There's a sort of personal brand of surrealism that he develops, particularly in the 1930s. Chelichev, although he's not often talked about, and in many cases is not mentioned at all, even in the index of like your standard surveys of modernism and modern art or 20th century painting or what have you, one of the places you will find him discussed is if you look at the admittedly less numerous surveys of, let's say, 20th century set design, theatrical design, or what have you, where Chelichev actually has a reputation and was considered to be a relatively important figure. This particular painting in some ways, I guess if you want to think about the parameters of the painting first, its origin, although this was finished in 1942 and worked on for basically a two-year period, it seems to have had its origin dating back to a drawing that Chelichev made in 1934, a very kind of academic drawing of a very old, gnarled tree that Chelyachev saw when he was staying at a friend's estate in England. And there are several versions of this drawing that have survived. Chelyachev claims to have seen this tree and seen its branches terminating in what looked to him like fingers, for the most part. So there was something very kind of biomorphic about this particular tree when Chelyachev first saw it. And he used this drawing as an origin point and kind of reworked it. There are various sketches and preliminary studies for this final painting. And it's actually hide and seek in its final version that you see on the screen is very complicated. What usually draws people to it is the fact that there are all sorts of hidden figures in the tree and around the tree. And a lot of you can probably see those already. You see mainly this series of heads. There are sort of one, two, three, four, five, six heads, the edge of which basically coincides with the outer outline of the bark of the tree, the trunk of the tree. And there's a girl who seems to be clutching the tree, hiding her face against it. It's been suggested that this part of the tree actually is reminiscent, this is Chelyachev's own explanation, of an old Viking's head, where this becomes one of the eyes, and here's the other eye, and here's the nose. This might be the sort of drooping mustache, the overall shape of the head. We find a hand here. We can find the toes of a foot extending out here. There are various other humanoid creatures, mostly children and babies. And even within those, there are all sorts of things happening as well. And you see these networks of what almost look like organic membranes and web-like motifs that can be interpreted as veins, blood vessels, etc. It's a very organic painting. It's very much a kind of a biomorphic painting. And I'll show you a detail, in fact, of that head on the right side of the painting. Well, this is, I have photographs of Chelyachev just so you can see what he looked like. And the painting again, and the detail, so that you can see even within the heads, there are kind of these layers of extra details, more figures, more forms, more symbols really kind of embedded, or if you like, encoded in this particular painting. So many of which, in fact, that a real complete understanding of this painting is almost precluded by its complexity. And people have talked about this. There is a literature about Chelyachev. The first monograph about him was written to accompany an exhibition of his here at MoMA by a writer named, or a curator named James Thrall Sobey, published in 1942. There's a catalog that went with the last retrospective of Chelyachev's work, certainly in the United States, which was in 1964 at the Foundation for Modern Art at 2 Columbus Circle, in that building that everybody either loves or hates and wants to see torn down or made as a landmark, etc. And there hasn't really been a retrospective of his work since then. So we're approaching basically like 45 years since anybody has looked at Chelyachev's work. And the last major monograph, and really the only major monograph on the artist, was published in the early 1970s by the film historian and critic Parker Tyler. I believe that was published 1971 or 72. So he's not an artist, you know, about whom an enormous amount of critical literature exists. If you're looking for a sort of starting point for Chelyachev's work, if you're looking for, you know, where does this kind of biomorphism come from, the obvious starting point, some of you may be familiar with the Renaissance artist Arsimboldo, who created these composite paintings. For example, this painting here is called Water. This is a 16th century painting where the figure representing water is made up entirely of sea creatures and products, aquatic products, if you like. You know, so it's really kind of a collaged together work in that sense. And that appears to be the starting point, and you know, nobody disagrees about that when they look at Chelyachev's Hide and Seek. What's interesting is that there are many other paintings. MoMA goers will only know Hide and Seek. That's the only work by Chelyachev in the permanent collection. He also painted a fairly well-examined work between 1936 and 1938. This is a painting called Phenomena. And it appears to be, this is a little bit closer to what we think of when we think of, for example, surrealism or magic realism in some ways. And this appears to be, according to Parker Tyler's explanation of the painting, Chelyachev's version of hell, where hell is populated largely by a series of what we used to call, for example, circus freaks, what we now just have to call differently abled entertainment performers. And all of those are splayed out along the canvas, etc. There's a little self-portrait of Chelyachev who, interestingly enough, placed himself in hell, much like Michelangelo in the great Last Judgment scene in the Sistine Chapel in Rome. Chelyachev is over on the bottom left-hand corner. And this is a painting which, for a long time, was in New York. Chelyachev, perhaps perversely, willed it to the Tretyakov Gallery of Modern Art in Moscow. And they were not particularly interested. They lent it to this show in 1964 at the Foundation for Modern Art. They were not particularly interested in getting it back for some reason. And I'm not really sure where the painting is. I was talking with another lecturer on Monday, and she said, actually, there are several studies and several earlier versions of phenomena which are in the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow. And in fact, they are on display. So it seems as if Chelyachev's reputation has been somewhat rehabilitated in the post-communist Soviet Union, or now as we have to go back to calling it Russia again. So he's not an unknown quantity, and he's not just filed away in the archives. People are aware of his art in a way that they perhaps hadn't been, I think, for several decades. The problem with Chelyachev, as far as curators are concerned, is where do you place him, you know, in the scheme of modernism? MoMA has a fairly well-thought-out and, in one sense, a kind of chronological version of the development of modernism in the late 19th and early 20th century. That's what you see on display in the galleries upstairs. It's a pretty consensus view of modernism. It's not something radically different than you would find in a survey course in college on modern art or basic textbooks on modern art, etc. But you also have Chelyachev painting at various times, for example, a work on the left called The Green Man, which was painted in the 1940s. And, you know, those of you who kind of know your modern art history, you look at that and you realize, well, that appears to be a rather late-breaking take on, let's say, synthetic cubism, which had been practiced in Europe by Picasso and his followers, Georges Braque, etc., in about 1912. And it's a little odd to think that Chelyachev is really working a variation on a style that at that point is nowhere near the avant-garde, you know, that had been sort of left behind several decades before. And what are we to make of these linear paintings that he began doing, particularly in the late 40s and early 50s? For example, on the right-hand side, that's just a work called Head from 1950, which is really done in terms of various kind of concentric lines. It has the quality of a kind of computer-generated diagram about it. And I've heard people somewhat disparagingly refer to this period of Chelyachev's late art as, you know, his spirograph period, where he's just sort of generating these geometrically inclined diagrams, et cetera, that don't seem to have a lot to do with his late-breaking cubism of the 40s, which in turn have very little to do with his own particular brand of, I guess we have to call it surrealism, that's present in something like Hide and Seek or the Phenomena painting. You know, so really the problem, if you're a curator here, I don't, again, want to put words into curators' mouths and say that nobody upstairs likes Andrew Wyatt's Christina's World, but they somehow feel compelled, you know, to display it. That probably is close to some version of the truth, but we're not, you know, nobody's going to really speak for attribution on that. With Chelyachev, the problem is a little bit different. It's not that the curators here, you know, don't like Hide and Seek. It's that you have to figure out a way to place it in some sort of context. And it's an enormous work. Chelyachev was not particularly associated with European surrealism because he'd mostly left Europe at the time. And that work would really look out of place, I think, in the big surrealist gallery on the fifth floor. It certainly, there's no room for it in that last small gallery, although I would love to see it right on the wall across from Christina's World. I think that would do poetic justice to both paintings in a lot of ways. A painting of that size requires wall space. Wall space is always limited. The question of where to fit Chelyachev into the story, how to narrate, you know, his particular role in modernism, because there's so much critical ambiguity about it anyway, I mean, it's a real challenge for the curators. I am happy to report, though, by the time we get to the end of this lecture today, which is essentially now, that there are plans to, if you like, deploy Hide and Seek in the collection again. And I talked to one of the curatorial assistants in the department just last week. There was serious consideration of, you know, how to get Chelyachev back out into the galleries, what sort of context, you know, it would be placed in, where it would go, how would you narrate Chelyachev's role, etc. And it's possible that within maybe a year, if the details are worked out, and the details of, you know, how this is going to happen, what room it's going to go in, are not really for publication yet, we may well see this painting back up on the walls in a year or so, at which point we will rejoice, possibly, and certainly go spend a lot of time. You can stand in front of Hide and Seek and spend as much time looking at it as you can in front of Jackson Pollock's Untitled Number One. I mean, it's a painting. You can stand there for half an hour and still not see everything in that painting. So it provides really a kind of a sense of visual delight for people who are willing to kind of be drawn into the painting. So I think we have that to look forward to. You can see Wyeth. You can go upstairs and see Christina's world now. Maybe you'll see it in a different light. And hopefully in a year's time, we'll hold a small celebratory reunion as we all go and look at Chelyachev. And I will give a gallery talk on it. I can promise that to you now. Once the painting gets back on view, I will try and devote at least one gallery talk to Chelyachev and where he fits in. So thank you very much for your time and attention today. We have time for a question or two, if anyone has anything. Yes?
Christina looks like an impressionistic painting rather than modern. How do you define that as modern art or impressionist?
I'm not sure that this would be, you know, classified as an impressionist painting just because the lines are so hard, the outlines are so, you know, kind of strongly placed in the painting. And if anything, the painting is about solidity of all these forms and not so much just about the light that reflects off them. So I'm not sure I would use the word impressionist to define it. An argument could be made that, well, this doesn't really fit in with all the various strands of modernism. It looks nothing like, I mean, first of all, it's completely realist. And by the time you get to when this painting was produced in the mid-20th century, I mean, abstraction is already very much a force in 20th century painting. And, you know, by the time you get to Pollock and the New York School and Pollock's great champion, the critic Clement Greenberg, you've got Greenberg making a case even in the 40s that because painting is essentially two-dimensional by nature, the only possible allowable subject matter for painting, of course, has to be abstraction. You know, the painting's role is not to create an illusion of three-dimensionality, which is what you have here, that painting should be about something else. It's this theory, which is, or this reaction, which is sometimes called medium specificity, where critics and artists have suggested that each medium should do what that medium does best, which first of all means identifying what the medium can do. Yes?
In your research, did you look at any work regarding the purchase of Christina's world to see
Well, what's interesting is the director of the museum at the time was Alfred Barr, you know, who has, of course, these very elaborately drawn out diagrams of modernism, etc. Barr, and this again, this is a fellow lecturer who's been doing some research in the archives here, etc. And she and I were chatting after the conclusion of Monday's lecture, and she was saying that, you know, all indications seem to be that Barr actually had a kind of a soft spot for, you know, this particular type of realism. You know, Barr was in the Soviet Union in the post-war period. He was there in the 1950s, and he didn't quite buy into this, you know, abstract expressionism or abstract art as, you know, kind of generic symbol of American freedom and individuality or whatever, that he seemed to kind of toe the line between realism and abstraction and tried to put together a kind of working, I wouldn't call it a theory, I'm not even sure I'd call it a philosophy, but really something, a very practical way of acknowledging the need for both, you know, in terms of post-war painting.
So then could you tie that purchase of Christina's work to the purchase or acquisition of other pictures in that same period? Or?
The thing is that MoMA doesn't have a lot of paintings like Christina's world from that period. What you'd have to do would be you have to go back and you have to look at the acquisitions record, and you actually would almost have to draw up or make a database of what gets bought every year and maybe categorize it somehow. I mean, MoMA has works by Thomas Hart Benton. There's two of them on display. We haven't seen him for a while in these galleries, I think. There are plenty of kind of realist or precisionist works. I shouldn't say plenty. I mean, there's a couple of Charles Sheeler's. You know, there are a few Georgia O'Keeffe's. But if you're looking at, you know, particularly this earlier version of American modernism, you don't really go to MoMA to look at that. You would go to the Whitney or you would go to the Met, which just simply have better collections of those things. And I think part of the interesting conundrum about Christina's world is, yes, it's an extremely well-known painting and you can pretty easily construct a narrative for it, but MoMA is not particularly rich in the sort of documents that would work well alongside of Christina's world. you know, that's why he's in the, that's why the painting is in the gallery with the Hopper and the Thomas Hart Benton and, you know, one Charles Sheeler. Because it's like, what else do you do with this painting? Yes.
But I think in the what else do you do with this painting that is quite valid, that the museum does as well as it can by this unique work. And for me, if they're going to have one Wyatt, one Andrew Wyatt in the collection, they might as well have an icon and call it this.
Well, I don't. They're not really about to buy any more Wyatts, as far as I know. I mean, I'm not totally privy to acquisition policies. Yeah, the painting is iconic, and you know, you could construct another whole lecture about why exactly is this an iconic painting. And in a way, it's. I mean, maybe it's just an accident that it's at MoMA, but it was purchased at the time. And of course, you know what the sort of curatorial view of what the collection is now, what it's supposed to do. Why would we expect that to be the same view that it was 50 years ago? You know, there is a mission statement at MoMA, but there are ways of interpreting that mission all along. And there are lots of museum practices now that weren't in existence 50 years ago and vice versa. Originally, MoMA wanted to dispose of works after they got to a certain age. And so lots of paintings, including Van Gogh's Starry Night, was marked to be sold to the Met or somebody else. And fortunately, that policy was on the books, in fact, until the 1950s. And fortunately, it was not really acted on and was finally done away with altogether. So part of it is just about how a museum defines itself and its collection. Yes?
Where is the Green Man located?
The Green Man, I think, is in a private collection in Europe. But I'd have to double check on that for you. That was a hard image to get a hold of. And there is not, surprisingly, there's not that much in the way of Chelyachev images.
And I feel I've seen it, but I don't know where.
It's quite possible. It also, I mean, it has a very kind of like Chagall-esque look to it. And if you, it looks a lot like, if you hadn't seen that painting before, you didn't know it was Chelyachev in the 40s, you think, oh, well, this is some synthetic cubism, maybe like 1915. I can't quite place the artist, but you could place it chronologically. Okay, well, thank you very much again for your time and attention. And enjoy the rest of your day.